Okay, picking up where we left off 2 weeks ago, we are on starting chapter 9 of the sixth dwelling place. We have 9, 10, and 11, and then we move into the seventh dwelling place. Okay, Teresa's talking about all the different ways God is really revealing himself to her and revealing herself to her as well. And she uses a lot of similes because she doesn't know how to explain some of the stuff. She said, well, it's like this, it's like that. Mm-hmm. And she tries to find something that people can relate to that kind of give them a sense of what's going on. And so she speaks again in similes, comparing this treasure to something more tangible. Mm-hmm. She says to consider having a golden vessel. In this vessel, we have a very precious stone mm-hmm. of highest value and having curative powers. She uses this imagery because in her time, there was a common belief among the people that certain stones had curative powers. One such was the bezoar. Huh. She says the powers of the stone remain as long as we have the stone with us. And I'd never heard of the bezoar stone, you know? And so I looked it up, and it said bezoar stones were once used as universal antidotes and panaceas, but currently regarded as costly and useless medicine of the past. They are a major milestone in the history of toxicology. Arabic physicians had been using bezoars in medicine from the 8th century on. Bezoar stones were actually a hardened mass of chewed hair formed in a ruminant animal stomach. So that gives you an idea it's not really a stone, okay? Since medieval times, the people have believed that these stones were endowed with healing properties, and they were used mainly as an antidote to poison. People can also develop these stones in their intestinal tract. If you have I can't imagine what that would be like. No. Imagine passing one. If you have a bezoar stone in your intestinal tract, 3.5 liters of Coca-Cola given nasogastrically or by mouth over 12 hours has been found to dissolve them. Wow. Coca-Cola dissolves almost anything, doesn't it?
Yeah, right.
So it says Coke, you take Coke and it'll get rid of that stone. So that was a very common thing around her time, and so she tries to use that as an example. Mm. It's something very precious, but it has curative powers. Mm. Teresa says, recalling what she previously said about being aware of Jesus always being present, and she keeps coming back to this point now for almost the rest of the book, that idea that he's always present with her, even when she's not looking at him, he's always present. About always being present, even though we have never seen this stone, we have experienced its healing power. We cannot open the reliquary because only the one to whom the stone belongs can open it. Comparing the stone to our Lord's sacred humanity, she says, when our Lord is pleased to give more delight to the soul, he shows it clearly his most sacred humanity in the way he desires, either as he was when he went about in the world or as he is after his resurrection. So he chooses how to appear to the person. In what form? Either as the glorious resurrected God or as the more human Jesus that walked among us. And even though the vision happened so quickly that we could compare it to a streak of lightning, this most glorious image remains so engraved on the imagination that I think it would be impossible to erase it until it is seen by the soul in that place where it will be enjoyed without end. And then she says, although I see it as an image, let it be understood that in the opinion of the one who sees it, it is not a painting but truly alive. And sometimes the Lord is speaking to the soul and even revealing great secrets. Even though the soul is detained by this vision for some while, it can no more fix its gaze on the vision than it can on the sun. The brilliance of this inner vision is like that of an infused light coming from a sun covered by something as transparent as a properly cut diamond. The garments seemed made of a fine Dutch linen. Almost every time God grants this favor, the soul is in rapture, for in its lowliness it cannot suffer so frightening a sight. I say frightening because although the Lord's presence is the most beautiful and delightful a person could imagine, even were he to live and labor 1,000 years thinking about it, for it far surpasses the limitations of our imagination or intellect, this presence bears such extraordinary majesty that it causes the soul extreme fright. Mm. It is clearly revealed that he is the Lord of heaven and earth. So Teresa is emphasizing that Jesus is always present to us, whether we experience it or not, and he will make his presence known at his own good pleasure and in the way he chooses. Have you ever had something happen a little like this, such as seeing the spinning sun or some other such experience, internal or external? Ever experienced anything like that?
I was driving with Pat Minahan. I remember how she was a lecturer in church for years and years and years. She's Carmelite, and we used to go to the meetings together. And she always prayed the rosary as we went to the meetings. Or if we had a lot of traffic, she'd say, Ellie, let's pray to God that he'll, as he separated the Red Sea, he'll separate the traffic. And I go, here we go. Anyway, so we were coming home one day, and it wasn't dark. And she says, look up in the sky. The sun was dancing in the sky to the two of us.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, I said, we don't keep your eye on the road. But we could see it dancing around. It wasn't going up and coming down to earth, but it was dancing in different spots.
Yeah.
It
was
cool. While you were saying the rosary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was.
Hey, Mary Beth and I saw that when we went to the apparition in Conyers.
Oh, really?
We were sitting outside the house waiting for things to happen. And we looked up and we saw two suns, double sun. One was brighter than the other, but they're right close together. And it looked like it had either a red or green disc in front of it, because you could sit there and just stare at it for like 20 minutes without it hurting your eyes.
Yeah.
And you can't do that with the sun normally, you know?
Yeah, we looked up. That's right. We were in the car, of course, with the glass.
Yeah.
It was like I said, it didn't have a color, but it was the sun with light around it.
Yeah. When we saw, and it was two of them side by side. And I had never heard of that before either, you know? And but you could sit there and just stare at it, you know? And then later on, when I got the little Pieta prayer book, I was reading about the lady that started that back in Italy. And the characteristic sign when she had an apparition was the double sun, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Wow.
You know? And then then in January, a couple of months, that was in October, in January, we went back, and Mary Beth had never been on retreat before, you know. So she went on retreat because she's a new convert. So she went over to the monastery, she and Father Collins, and they went on retreat. So I kept the boys in the hotel while they were there. And so Nathan and Daniel, like 5 or 6 years old, you know, they said, we want to go back and play with the Blessed Mother. She had a, in the back of Nancy's house in a big yard, there was a big statue of the Blessed Mother. And they wanted to go back and play. And so I took them back there and let them go play with the Blessed Mother, you know. And then I was looking up and I could see this sun spinning again. You know, it was really pretty. And it was like her saying thanks for, because it was freezing cold that day. I mean, it was really cold. And I was surprised because it was Alabama, you know? Or whatever it is.
Georgia.
My daughter Susan was by a lake in Minnesota, and she was there praying and everything. She said, this, she knew it was real. She saw a big host over the water. And then she said, as the waves came in, that big host came into the water and it became two. And then it became three and four and five and six. She said the whole front, the whole area was filled with hosts as the waves came in, and they kept multiplying. She said it was mind-boggling.
Yeah, which is what happens when a priest consecrates the chalice, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because it's a ciborium.
Yeah, it was.
It's all consecrated.
You don't get stuff like that often. I mean, I mean, it's not made up.
We took a lot of pictures when we went to Medjugorje in October. And we all were showing each other, and like the sun, it's not. It's kind of like the shape of Mary.
Yeah.
When you look back, I didn't notice it then. I mean, I thought the sun looked kind of different there.
Yeah.
To begin with. But, you know, we have some unique ones. And everybody points out these little tiny blue circles that's like in the bottom of the picture.
Yeah.
And even my sister-in-law has a friend that went to Fatima. And there's in hers, too. And she says they're like angels or something.
It could be. Yeah.
Well, I went back and I had them in some of mine, too.
Yeah. Like, well, the angels are always going to be accompanying her, you know, where she goes.
Yeah.
So it's just a little.
Yeah,
little
when I went to Medjugorje, we were outside of the house of.
Vika?
No, the other one.
We were
Mariana. Yeah, we were in front of Mariana, so I was waiting for her to come out and talk.
Oh, wow.
And I looked up, and there was a sun up there, but there was this, like, a red angel up there over the sun, you know?
Wow.
And there was a priest with us that I recognized from being on EWTN. He does stuff on EWTN.
Yeah.
And the minute Mariana walked out of the house, that red angel went flying away. And so I asked him, I said, what's all that about? He said, well, that was the devil. But the minute Rihanna came out,
he didn't want to be there.
The Blessed Mother was with her. And so he flew away, you know. Because it was really interesting to look at, because you see this red thing, all of a sudden, it's gone, it's flying away, you know. We had a lot of interesting things happen on that trip, you know.
Whoa.
And a lot of them are subtle. You know, if you're not paying attention, you miss them. You know? But it was interesting.
That makes the devil so real, you know, when you see something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, he's real.
So that's kind of funny. But, you know, those kind of signs will happen to you. But you got to be aware. You know, if you're not paying attention, you know, you're going to miss it. If you're not looking up, you're not going to see the sign.
But they say they're so common right now because, you know, Satan's getting ready to be... caged.
Yeah.
And the time of mercy is almost over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. And so thousands of people are having signs.
Yeah. It could be. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, the Gospel of Luke says, you know, when he comes again, don't be afraid. Look up and rejoice, because your time is close.
Yeah. April.
Okay. Next paragraph. Teresa says that she has never had a fear of the torments of hell, for they would be nothing if compared to what I recall the condemned will experience upon seeing the anger in these eyes of the Lord's so beautiful, meek, and kind. How much more, and then she says, how much more will the person fear this sight to whom the Lord has thus represented himself, since the experience is so powerful that it carries that person out of his senses. The reason the soul is suspended must be that the Lord helps its weakness, which is joined to his greatness in this sublime communication. Yeah, when you see her say things like this, it really makes you think about what it must be like for somebody in a state of really great sinfulness to all of a sudden stand before God. And he's saying, look at what I did for you. Why didn't you pay attention? You know? And just that, you know, everything I did for you, and you just turned away from it.
Wow.
You know? And he would, because I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, that's just me. But I think that he shows people what their life could have been if they had followed him. And so what they lost by going the way they did.
At Medjugorje, the girls say everyone gets that experience at death, what God planned for you.
Yeah, and how you failed.
And the way you went.
I think there's got to be a lot of stubborn people that would just sit there and say, yeah, but, you know, I saw this choice and I thought I should do this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be people that just, I think,
we're just like Adam and Eve.
Levels.
You know, they had a choice.
Yeah, I always had the thought. You know, thoughts come, and you don't—they're not from books, or you don't even know years ago that they're spiritual. You know what I mean? They're just the thoughts. And I always used to say, when I stand before God, I want to be the person that He expected me to be.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know,
Well, that's what we hope.
Yeah, right, don't you? When you think of it, you don't want to... I said, I don't want to disappoint you. I mean, we're never going to be exactly... I mean, the saints were probably, but... Or I always say, I wanted to fulfill your will. I didn't want to miss the boat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that...
Well, don't you think you have things in your life that show you that you've been on the right path?
Oh, yes.
So,
Oh, yeah, I know I'm on the right path. I'm not saying how perfect, but, you know what I mean? I know I'm on the right path. Of course, with Catholics, if you stay faithful, you're on the right path.
I mean, like guideposts that are saying, okay, you have been doing it the way I want you to. I don't know. Do you think sometime we went on the wrong path, but then we got right back on it, and then...
What I do is I connect the dots. I mean, you don't know, like, God's will. It's not written out like this.
Yeah.
But if you look back, you can see why things happened and why they led to where you are now. I can always look back and say, oh, that happened because of this, and it led to that.
I think it's kind of like a pool table, you know, where you get the ball, and you hit the ball, and that begins your life. And as you go through your life, he's going to kind of nudge you so that you go into the pocket. You know, you miss it, you go all the way over here, oh, get back over here, you know. As long as you're trying, he's going to keep nudging you in the right direction.
Yeah.
Or you could just go haywire and say, forget it, and you end up in a side pocket instead of the pocket he wanted you to go.
Or if you make a mistake, I always thought somehow he brings you back to make the right decision.
Yeah.
You know, you might not have done it the first time, but it's a roundabout way, but...
But it's tricky because he doesn't want to upset your free will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a big deal. And so he's got to try to inspire you so that you make the choice, but you make the right choice, you know.
And that's all through prayer, and so many people don't get the benefit of prayer in their life, and they never
That's right.
They don't get help. They must feel very alone, and I'm in this big world, and I'm all by myself, and
Well, that's a lot of it. People feel like they're totally on their own. And that's why you see so many of them committing suicide.
Because
they say, I can't take this, you know.
Right.
And instead of turning to God for help, they say, I got to get out of here, and they just commit suicide.
Sad.
It's really sad. Very sad.
I always think I'd like to start my life over again, knowing what I know now.
Oh, yeah. I used to tell my grandchildren to be your age and know what I know now.
Yeah.
And I think about all the times that I didn't even think of God, and I think, I'm so sorry, all those years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can we start over? That's what I think. Can we start over?
Well, you can't unring a bell, you know, so you just kind of keep going forward.
Yeah.
Teresa then speaks about some people who are so absorbed in their imagination that they believe they see everything they think about. Yet if they were to see a real vision, they would know without any doubt whatsoever their mistake. So they themselves are composing what they see with their imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So some people do have a very fertile imagination.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when you talk to lawyers, they say that the most unreliable testimony is an eyewitness. Because they see what they think. When you write something, you should never proofread your own word. Because you know what you wanted to say, and when you read it, you think that's what you wrote, and you miss what you actually wrote.
Yeah.
It's better to have somebody else proofread your work for you, you know?
My husband used to say to me, because he had a good sense, he would say, you hear what you want to hear. It's true.
And some people do. Have you been to the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception in Washington? If so, what was your first thought when you saw the huge mosaic of Jesus in the judgment seat?
He looks mean.
He looks like he's really,
That art gets a lot of criticism for that.
Really?
Really?
My first thought when I saw it was, wow, the majesty and the power of that.
Right.
Whoa.
Like the Sistine
Chapel. It blew my mind.
Like when they show like the death and the that's like, I mean, wouldn't you think that would turn some people's thoughts when they go and visit that?
But how many people go visit it, though, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Hmm?
How many people go visit it who aren't already kind of disposed?
Yeah.
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 But they get a lot of different people going through there.
Right.
That was just on EWTN yesterday. They did a baptism of babies, and they had it in that room. And I'm like, wow, just imagine being there and get your child baptized in the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be kind of cool.
Hmm. It could... like you said, fear. It could be, it could strike you like a person with fear of the Lord.
Yeah.
Oh, he's so majestic, you know.
Yeah.
And then you think, oh, what have I done so far? Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah.
You mean that person I hit with my car, I shouldn't have done?
So Teresa says these visions come upon the soul suddenly and without any expectation. And suddenly the vision is represented to it all at once and stirs all the faculties and senses with a great fear and tumult, so that to place them afterward in that happy peace. If the vision stirs the soul with great fear and tumult, why is the result a happy peace?
Could it be down deep? You know it is the Lord. I don't know.
What do you think she means about fear and tumult?
Maybe she means awe.
Oh, reverence?
Yeah.
I don't want to offend him.
I think that that's a big part of it, because I think if when you first see something like that, you're going to, boy, is he here? What's he appearing to me for? Is he going to slap me up the head? Mm. Or is he going to just teach me something? You know, you kind of wonder, you know, what have I done, or did I do okay? It's like when the principal calls you in. You say, am I being called in because I did something wrong, or am I called in because I did something good?
Bored.
You know?
I get that when there's a police car behind me. I go, oh, geez, I look at my speedometer. I have the fear of the police because my daughter said, you go too fast, Mom.
I think of it, you get a call in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Like, oh, your heart just sinks. Oh,
yeah.
It's not going to be good news.
Yeah. But he ends up giving you this peace, this happy peace. And so that kind of tells you that he's pleased and he's trying to draw you closer and closer and closer. And I think that's the thing that is enough of an incentive to let you continue to do his will and try to do everything he wants you to do.
It's so overwhelming. It's so unexpected and...
Yeah.
So how could you ever forget it?
That's right.
Yeah.
I imagine you never forget that kind of thing. And she continues, this soul is left so well instructed about so many great truths that it has no need of any other master. For without any effort on the soul's part, true wisdom has taken away the mind's dullness and leaves a certitude, which lasts for some time, that this favor is from God. However much the soul is told the contrary, others cannot then cause it fear that there could be any deception. So when she talks about others, she's talking about people she tells about the vision, like some of the confessors. She had a lot of problems with confessors, you know.
They wouldn't believe that.
They didn't believe anything she was telling them, you know. So, and then you have to do what they say, though, in order to get absolution, right? So she was in a quandary a lot of times, until she finally found a confessor who could understand what she was doing. Speaking of how the devil may try to interfere, she says the devil can present a vision, but not with this truth and majesty and these results. So he'll try to fool you.
No peace,
right? He'll try to fool you. And he'll take on different shapes, like he did with Eve. You know, he came as a serpent. In other words, you know, do the same thing. But
I always wonder why God allows Satan to disturb the saints like that.
Mm.
There must be a greater good that comes from it.
Yeah.
But like Padre Pio is always fighting.
Like he's wrestling
why
in the
does God
of
allow that? What's the purpose?
I think he does that to irritate the Satan.
Because he knows that he will not be successful.
Right.
Yeah. Like with Job. Yeah. He knew.
Well, look at Padre Pio, you know. His spiritual directors would send him letters in French asking him questions, and he didn't know French. But his guardian angel would translate for him. And then he would answer back in Italian. And it says that they did that just to irritate the devil. Because they knew that his angel would translate for him.
Wow.
Yeah. Some of those, that when you read those letters between him and his spiritual directors, they're just amazing.
Crazy.
Absolutely amazing. She then, after speaking of confessors, who cannot witness the vision. She says, thus it's necessary to proceed with caution. Wait for the time when these apparitions will bear fruit and move along little by little, looking for the humility they leave in the soul and the fortitude and virtue. If the vision is from the devil, he will soon show a sign and will be caught in a thousand lies. So what does he leave you with? Well, first of all, he lies. And then secondly, it's always unquiet. There's always anxiety. Unsettled disturbance, you know. You don't feel calm. You don't feel peace. You don't feel love when he's around. Because he's all the opposite of all those things. In addition to the certitude of wisdom felt in the soul from these apparitions, what else tells the soul the visions are genuine?
Is it the peace that's experienced?
Yeah. And also what God, I think what God teaches you about himself and yourself.
Okay.
Because the devil doesn't know. The devil can't teach you those things. And she was talking about the certitude of what she hears in the visions.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you feel more love for Jesus too?
Right.
Yeah.
When
exactly.
You automatically, it would draw you closer to him.
Yeah, because you would feel love and peace.
Yeah.
And since Satan cannot love, you would never feel that from anything he does with you.
Yeah.
Teresa then comes back to the issue of confessors. She really had a problem with them. I feel sorry for her. She says that in addition to any sins, we must proceed openly and truthfully with our confessor. We must give a truthful account of our prayer. If you do not do this, she says, it is not God who is teaching you. She says of Jesus, he is very fond of our speaking as truthfully and clearly to the one who stands in his place as we would to him, and of our desiring that the confessor understand all our thoughts and even more of our deeds, however small they be. If you do this, you don't have to go about disturbed or worried. So what is this openness and truthfulness with our confessor a sign of?
Humility.
Yeah. Humility.
You say purity of heart, like no duplicity in the person?
All that stuff, yeah. All those things are wrapped together there. Mm. You're being open. You're not trying to hide anything back. You're treating the confessor like he's Jesus, because he's standing in the person of... When he's your confessor, he's standing in persona Christi. And so you talk to him the way you would talk to Christ. And since you can't hide anything from Christ, you don't want to hide anything from him.
Mm. I think about the times when I first went to confession, and I think about like my children, that I think you're so nervous and you're not saying it all, or you can't get it out.
Sometimes you don't know how to explain it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And it takes this, you know, when you start doing the, you know, Five First Saturdays and stuff, it takes all these years of going.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think of that and how, you know, well, maybe that's a sign of how far you come or something, that you're not in there just going, everything. Yeah. Everything. Forgive
me. Piracy on the high seas. That's what it's. Yeah. Some kids look through the book and just pick out stuff.
So then Teresa says, a wonderful benefit the soul draws from this favor of the Lord is that when it thinks of him or of his life and passion, it remembers his most meek and beautiful countenance. She then cautions us, would advise you strongly that when you learn or hear that God grants these favors to souls, you never beseech him or desire him to lead you by this path.
What does that mean?
It means when you see how God is dealing with one person, like Teresa. If Teresa came and told you about what's going on with her, she says you should not then go to God
person.
And say, please do the same thing for me.
Oh, okay.
Because he's going to treat you like an individual. He knows what you need, and so you trust him to give you what you need, not what somebody else needs.
Okay.
And I think that's the big thing there. Mm. You know, a lot of it is trust. You remember what Jesus told Faustine about trust? Everything says the same thing here. You trust him to do for you what he knows you need, and you don't try to tell him what to do for you. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's, I think that's what she's putting into here. Why would Teresa caution us against asking God to lead? By the way, we just talked about that.
Okay. Yeah.
Teresa answers that question in section 15. She says she believes these favors will never be given to those who desire them. Mm. And one of the reasons there is because if you see somebody has them, and then you say, I want them too, you're trying to raise yourself.
Right.
And instead of letting God raise you.
And tell God what to do. I mean, right?
Yeah. It sounds a little like envy, too.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's envy. Indeed. Because you say, well, that person's really holy because God appears to them. So please prepare to me, too, so I can be holy. You know, it's envy.
Pride.
And pride and those kind of things. And, and you want to think well of yourself. You want to think that you're holy. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe you're not quite ready to do that yet.
You know, I read once in a book, it said, if you're praying and you think you're praying, you're really not praying because you're thinking of yourself. You're not thinking of God.
I think that's hard.
Right, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you think about yourself praying,
we're so self-centered, it's just hard not to be.
It shows us how we are, right?
It's a human weakness. Yeah.
Yeah. That and pride too. That comes up a lot of times. So.
Sure.
Yeah.
She says she believes these favors will never be given to those who desire them because before granting them, God gives a deep self-knowledge. So once again, she goes back to the self-knowledge thing. Humility and self-knowledge are the two things she talks about throughout the whole book. She also says that desiring what you have not deserved shows a great lack of humility. She also says such a person will very certainly be deceived or in great danger because the devil will take advantage of any lack of humility, however small, to attack us. So when you start asking for this gift, the devil sees you asking. And he says, okay, I'm going to try to interfere here because that's a lack of humility. I might get a foot in the door here and get this person. Mm. She again speaks about a person with an active imagination believing they see what they think. She says it would be very bold to want to choose a path while not knowing what suits it best. She also says the trials suffered by those who are taken along this path are extraordinary and of many kinds. Finally, by the very way you think you will gain, you will lose, as Saul did by being king. Mm. The point here is to let God choose our path, whatever that path is. He will never choose a path for you that is not good for your spiritual growth. Can you think of an example from Scripture where someone wanted a special favor and didn't get it?
The only person came to mind was Moses. Didn't he want to go to the Promised Land and he died before?
Oh, yeah.
That's
one.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Couldn't think of anything else.
Samson?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How about Judas?
That was in the end. I thought of Judas.
You know, when you think of him, you know, God said, follow me. And he's supposed to follow him. And because because Jesus wasn't giving him what he expected, he decided to go a different way.
It didn't work out too good.
Yeah. Even David for a time, you know. God said, he is after my own heart, you know. But yet eventually he committed murder and adultery. And he had to repent.
I would just think this probably isn't right, but the lady in the Bible who wanted her two sons to sit at the right hand of Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
But it's amazing how you can have the gifts that David had and still go wrong.
Yeah, and Solomon too. Look at what he did, you know. The wisest man who ever lived, and he got sucked in by all the false gods.
Hmm.
And that's an interesting example because all those false gods might have been just the demons of hell.
Mm. Oh, I bet they were.
They got that book that says The Return of the Gods, you know? And so all of them, from his 700 wives, you know, were attacking Solomon, and in his old age he couldn't resist.
Too many wives.
Too many wives. Too many wives. That's right. I wonder if he even knew any of them. You know, I mean, he got married to create relationships between countries.
Yeah.
I doubt if he even knew the names of 90% of them.
You know that show on TV? I don't watch it. Sister Wives?
Oh, yeah. Oh.
I don't know if he's... Oh.
Yeah. So now we start chapter 10. We'll get into this a little bit, and then it'll be time to quit for the day. In this chapter, Teresa speaks about other favors and their benefits. So as she's going through, she's talking about all the different kind of favors that God showed her because of her growth in holiness. Teresa says that if what we see is an authentic vision and understand such things are possible, we won't go about disturbed or afflicted. This is important. When I read that, the first person I thought about was Mary. Because when Gabriel appeared to her, she didn't seem surprised. I think if an angel appears to you for the first time, you're going to be really surprised, right?
Right.
I mean, whoa, what's going on? You know, what is this? But she didn't seem very surprised. So my suspicion, and it's just me, nothing says this happened. I think she had a lot of visions of angels.
Right, from her childhood.
From the
childhood. Well, in Mary of Agreda, that book, you know, that I did, it said, on the journey from, what was it, I guess Nazareth to Bethlehem, there were 10,000 angels, Mary of Agreda saw them, conversing with Our Lady.
Uh-huh.
And Joseph didn't speak because he knew she was... Oh, no, the angels appeared to Joseph. He saw them, and he didn't speak to her. So she must have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
So I think she... When you look at what she was, you know, from birth, from her conception... You think that there would be a real close relationship there. And so I think the only thing that surprised her was the angel saying, you're going to have a kid. You know?
Yeah.
Says, how's that going to happen?
Yeah.
And when you think about that, she must have talked about that with Joseph beforehand, before they got betrothed.
Right.
You know, you don't spring that on somebody on your wedding night. And saying, I got good news and bad news. I'm going to be the mother of God. Oops, sorry, Joseph. You know, you just don't do that kind of thing.
But weren't they betrothed for a year or so?
Well, usually they're betrothed long enough for him to build a house.
Oh.
Usually they would get betrothed, make the commitment. Because they're actually married at that point.
But you don't live together.
Because he then goes off, builds the house.
Okay.
When that's done, he comes back and gets her to bring it to his house.
Okay.
And he's a carpenter, so he probably did a pretty decent job building a house. You know.
Wow.
I think a saint carpenter would build a nice house.
I would think. She's alive.
I think if I was a saint carpenter, I'd try to build a nice house for my wife who was going to give birth to the Son of God, you know.
Yeah, and then she had to go to a cave.
Yeah.
Right. Oh,
to give the birth, yeah. So, this is important because the devil gains much if he sees a soul who is disquieted and afflicted. And he will use that to his advantage whenever possible. He is happy because he knows that a soul so disturbed cannot be totally occupied with loving and praising God. If you were to experience an authentic vision for the first time, what could you do to maintain your composure and not be disquieted and afflicted? I've thought about this a lot. Not that I'll ever get a vision, but I often wonder what I would do if it did happen.
I can't imagine being prepared.
My first impulse, I think, would be, well, to pray, and then to ask God. I would probably say, is this real or not? Please
let me know. Well, St. Paul says test the spirits, right?
Yeah.
So the first thing I think I would do is ask them to pray the divine praises with me. Because I don't think Satan could do that.
Right.
Or devil
could
do that.
That's good.
Yeah.
So we just say, you know, it doesn't take long.
Right.
Yes. Blessed be God. Blessed be His holy name.
Praise be Jesus Christ.
That's right.
Say that.
That's right. So I don't think he could do that. And so the first thing I would do is say, would you please pray the divine praises with me?
Yeah. Or you could show your crucifix or your medal of Mary.
Yeah.
He would run from that.
Yeah, could be. So, you know, just think about it, because one day you might get a vision. You never know. I mean, you know, you never know. It could happen. It could happen to anybody.
And you shouldn't put it on YouTube.
I don't think it would ever go on YouTube.
I just think all the disquiet.
But you know,
wasn't there a time that everybody, when COVID hit, that everybody was disquiet? And just think of all that took away from people praying to God.
Yeah.
Kind of got in your head.
Yeah.
And all the stuff that was going on. I remember just being in a mess.
I think that's why people are still so disturbed. Yeah. Because it so upset their lives.
Yeah. And they didn't come back to God. I mean, I think it got a lot of people off the road or distracted us with all this disquiet and unease.
Yeah. There was a video I was watching the other day by Klaus Schwab for the World Economic Forum. You saw that?
No, but I have read it. It was interesting.
And he was talking about COVID. He said this: it was one of the first steps for actually control.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah.
You know? And he's got other things planned as well. They want just total control of people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And they keep coming out with a new COVID shot. And my dear cousin in Maryland, she gets all these shots. And she said, oh, you know, we got the third COVID shot or something. And 3 days later, my husband got so sick. He's probably 83, 84. The worst sickness ever. Then she got it. And then they said, well, we think it might have been from the COVID. So if they don't kill you with the first shot, you're going to give them six chances?
They're saying that it's really dangerous to keep taking it because it has an adverse from what it's supposed to.
Yeah, it changes your DNA.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
It's frightening that they keep getting these things.
I got the first shot because they wouldn't let me go on a cruise unless I got it, you know?
Yeah.
That's the only reason I got it. Mary Beth got it because her job required it.
You have to do certain
things. After the first one, we never got another one. And then right after we got the first one, we got the monoclonal antibodies, and that stopped it from replicating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that was helpful.
Yeah.
What do you remember? What preparation that was? What drug? The monoclonal antibody.
I don't know. They just called it monoclonal antibodies, and it was an infusion.
There's a name of one. I can't remember.
My daughter got that. It was good. She was over it like 3 days.
Yeah,
she was back
to
normal.
Yeah, they would give it to everybody, but I can't think of the name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's about 10:20. Let's get stopped here. We'll pick up chapter 10 next time, and continue on, and then move on to final chapters.
Okay.
Anybody have any final thoughts before we quit for the day?
We already said all of them.
Yeah, we talked about everything.
I guess it's good to know all this stuff, but sometimes it creeps in like, why am I reading all this? But I guess it's good to know.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
It's good.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you,